Make this Christmas memorable with Goat Guns. Get the coolest miniature gun models for your collection. From historical classics to modern weapons, we have something for every firearm and hobby enthusiast. Surprise your loved ones with the gift of Goat Guns, the perfect blend of quality and detail. Shop now and spread the joy at GoatGuns.com.
Deadcast. January 14th, 1975. Highley, Shropshire, England. It was the early morning hours when the mother of 17-year-old Leslie Whittle called her daughter downstairs for breakfast. When she did not appear, the mother went upstairs and checked in the girl's room, seeing no sign of her. She then went into another room in the upstairs, a sort of parlor, where she found a note pressed out in red dynamo tape. It read, "No police. £50,000 ransom to be ready to deliver. Wait for telephone call at Swan Shopping Center. Telephone box, 6 p.m. to 1 p.m. If no call, return following evening when you answer. Give name only and listen. You must follow instructions without argument. From time you answer, you are on time limit. If police or tricks, death. Swan Shopping Center, Kidderminster. Deliver £50,000 in a white van. £50,000 in all white notes. £25,000 in £1 notes. And £25,000 in £5 notes. There will be no exchange. Only after £50,000 has been cleared will victim be released." With the finding of this note, the man known as the Black Panther, who had terrorized Britain for years, had struck again. Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. And today we are going to be looking at the case of the Black Panther, also known as Donald Nielsen. Before we get into the story, however, I have a few show notes as well as some plugs. If you'd like to follow me on social media, that would be YouTube, Instagram, or Facebook. Just search for Ian Totten Author, or you can go to Google and type in Ian Totten. All of the links to my pages will appear. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, just look for Corpse Creek. If you would like to sign up for the mailing list, just go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com. Sign up for the mailing list. While you're there, consider possibly making a donation. There is a donate button on that page. All donations go towards helping to produce this show. That's one thing people don't seem to realize, is that putting this show on all the various platforms it's on costs money. And despite the fact that on a few of the platforms there are ads inserted into the show, I don't see any of that money. It doesn't come back to the show, or at least it has not as of yet. So every donation does help with keeping the archives of this show up on all of the various platforms that it is on. If you like and enjoy the Deathcast, please like and subscribe wherever it is that you get your podcasts. Leave a review and share it on social media. Let people know about the show. We are growing by leaps and bounds, which is something that is amazing to me, with roughly around 80 downloads a day, which to some people is not a big deal, but for me, I didn't think I'd get 25 downloads in a week, so I appreciate those of you who follow and share, and enjoy this labor of love that I put out every week. If you would like to find any of my books, that would be the Blood Gods Trilogy, The House of Silver Doors, or The Throwaway Girls of Olympia, you can find them on Amazon, Kindle, also on Audible, as well as on Barnes & Noble or any bookstore that is in your area. They may not carry them, but they can get them for you. All right, now that all the business is out of the way, get yourself something to drink, sit back, relax, close your eyes. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. As you heard in the trailer, we are going to be looking at a kidnapping today. But it's much more than just a simple kidnapping, as the man responsible, Donald Nielsen, committed a slew of other crimes and murders prior to this kidnapping, with some estimates putting the number of burglaries that he was responsible for prior to coming to police attention at around the 400 mark. This kidnapping of Leslie Whittle, however, really thrust him into the national spotlight. Now, after the ransom note was found, the family debated about what it was that they were going to do, and eventually Leslie's brother, Ronald, brought in the police, letting them know what the ransom note had said, and that if the kidnapper became aware of the police's presence, he would more likely than not kill the young girl. So the police decided to let the family go ahead with what had been in the note, getting the money together, and then going and waiting for the phone calls. However, this was bungled, as somehow a reporter found out about what was going on and gave the story to a local radio station, who decided to broadcast the story. Because of this, the police decided that they needed to withdraw Mr. Whittle from the area where the indicated phone box was. Unfortunately, the phone did ring just before midnight, but no one was there to pick it up. That same evening that the phone call was to take place, a security guard named Gerald Smith, who was working at a Freightliner yard, noticed a man skulking around the fence, and when he went to approach the man, he was shot for his troubles. The man took off from this depot, leaving behind a car that he had stolen, a green Morris 1300 series. Now, this car is important because key pieces of evidence were inside of it. However, it would be a number of days. Some reports have it as only a few, while others have that it was over a week later before police took notice of the car. The security guard survived this shooting and was able to crawl to a telephone where he alerted police to what had just taken place. On January 16th, Ronald Whittle received a phone call from a man who claimed to be Leslie's kidnapper. After following the instructions that were given to him, however, it was quickly found that he was being sent on a wild goose chase. To the best of my knowledge, from everything that I have read on this case, no one has ever been tied to this particular phone call, which is seen by most as a hoax. The following evening, that's the third night since Leslie disappeared, the family received another phone call, and this one apparently had a recording of Leslie's voice, and it told him to go and wait by a phone in Kidsgrove. Now, there's conflicting stories on this particular evening. Some state that he was waiting at home when the phone call came. Others that he went back to the original place that the family had been told to wait for a phone call. In any event, he was led from wherever it was that he had gotten this phone call to a series of Dymo-taped messages that were apparently stuck on various items. The kidnapper had typed them out and placed them on these various places, whether it was telephone poles or on mailboxes, and instructed the family that, you know, this is where you'll find them when you get to the place. Eventually, he arrived at Bathpool Park, which was near the town of Kidsgrove, Staffordshire. And before arriving at the destination, he was briefed by the police as to what he should do. The police told him to follow the kidnapper's instructions to the letter and that they would move in on the man after he gave the signal of flashing from a flashlight and arrest him. Well, along the way to this final destination, Mr. Whittle got lost a number of times and did not arrive at the park until about 3 a.m., after which it took him another estimated half an hour to locate the message left from the kidnapper. After flashing the headlights of his car, Mr. Whittle waited for a while and received no response, after which he drove home after talking to police. According to some sources, witnesses were in the park at that point in the evening, and they stated that at one point they saw a police cruiser come through, and that around 2:30 they saw someone flashing a flashlight, although they did not realize what it was that was going on. And that's important to take note of, as Mr. Whittle did not arrive until 3 a.m., a half an hour later, and did not find the message that the kidnapper had left until roughly 3:30. So about an hour after the kidnapper had supposedly flashed his flashlight is when the victim's father did as he was instructed, all to no avail. There was no communication after this point with the kidnapper. A few days after this failed meeting in the park, the media had grabbed a hold of this and were really publicizing the kidnapping and the failed attempts at retrieving the young girl. A student went to his teacher and handed them a Dynatape note that they had found in the park, and it stated to drop the money in the hole. The headmaster then turned around and contacted the local authorities, who began a search of the park, and what they found was a flashlight jammed into the grill of a drainage ditch. This in turn led them to start looking around further in the park, and they eventually found the body of Leslie Whittle in one of these drainage ditches. These drainage ditches, from what I can understand, were large underground shafts made of concrete that ran underneath the park that rainwater would flow into. Inside of these concrete tubes, there were a number of iron ladders. You've seen them in movies. They're, the bent iron rungs that are actually sunken into the concrete to allow access both to the tunnels and then back out of them, usually by means of a manhole cover or a grate above ground. Police brought in tracker dogs, and the dogs eventually led them down into these underground tunnels where they found Leslie's body. A wire noose had been secured around her throat and then fastened to one of the rungs on this ladder, and it appeared that she had been standing on a ledge with her hands bound and was eventually shoved off of this ledge, at which point she was strangled to death. Naturally, the news of the young girl's death enraged the populace, and the story began receiving a lot more press coverage. And during this period of time, the car that the perpetrator had stolen was found outside of the Freightliner depot. The police began to search this car, and inside of it, they found snippets of a further ransom note typed out on this dynamo tape, which, if I am correct in understanding, it's kind of like labeling tape that you would put inside of a labeling gun that punches the letters into it so that they appear on the tape in white. Also inside of this car, they found a sleeping bag, a recording of Leslie's voice, a gun, ammunition, as well as other flashlights. Unfortunately, however, they were unable to find any indicators as to who the perpetrator of the crime was. When the security guard, Gerald Smith, who had been shot, the bullets were removed from his body, police were able to eventually link them to another series of crimes that had taken place in the general area over the course of the last few years. And it was at this point that the furor in the country really exploded, because this man had become known as the Black Panther. And he got this moniker not so much for the crimes that he committed, but the manner in which he dressed when doing them. He was always seen in a pair of black pants, boots, a camouflage army fatigue jacket, a bandoliera with shotgun shells on it, as well as a black ski mask. Not the kind with the two separate holes for the eyes, but it had a strip across just where the eyes were. So if you envision a like a ninja's type mask, that's similar to what he was wearing. He also wore white gloves and carried a sawed-off double-barrel shotgun. Police had been after this individual for a number of years, and he was known under a variety of nicknames throughout the course of his criminal career. One was the Phantom, another was Handy Andy. And he would break into homes and steal items, which he would later turn around to sell, but most of the time he was looking for money. But he would switch things up during the course of these robberies. He might hit a string of houses and steal something as innocuous as a tea kettle and then leave them nearby. And once the police became aware of this pattern, he would switch it up again to, you know, steal something like, you know, the family Bible or a radio and, you know, do something else with that. And he did this in order to try and confuse the police so that they could not figure out if it was the same individual who was hitting these houses time and time again. It wasn't until sometime in the late 1960s, early 1970s, that he was able to get his hands on guns, which he stole from a number of different houses. And at this point, he turned to robbing small post offices, which in Britain are called sub-post offices. We have them here in the States. They're the kind of post office that you go into where they have the normal things that you would expect from a post office, but they don't offer all of the services that you could expect to find at a larger post office in, say, a city. Between 1971 and 1974, it is known that at least 18 post offices were robbed. I think it's important to note that during the course of these robberies, Nielsen became progressively more aggressive towards the occupants of the post offices, as a lot of these post offices, the postmaster and their family actually lived on the premises. And I've seen this myself where, you know, it'll be a split building with the post office in the front, and in the back you'll have either a regular-sized house or a smaller dwelling where the family will live. One story about the aggressiveness of Nielsen comes from February of 1972 in Rochdale Road in Haywood, Lancashire, where Leslie Richardson, who was the postmaster, and his wife awoke to find a hooded man inside of their bedroom, and a fight broke out. And supposedly, Nielsen spoke to the homeowner in what has been described as a fake West Indies accent, showing him his shotgun and stating that it was loaded. The gun eventually went off, blasting two holes in the ceiling of the house, and the homeowner, Richardson, was able to pull off the assailant's hood, at which point Nielsen stomped on the man's foot and broke several of the toes, before kneeing him in the groin and making his escape. Richardson and his wife gave a description of their assailant to police, and from this they created what in Britain is called a photo fit, and it was found to be fairly inaccurate later when the perpetrator was arrested. I'm going to give you a brief description of a photo fit. It's unlike here in the U.S. where police will draw up a picture of the man they believe responsible. They will take drawings or actual pictures of different parts of the face, from the ears, the eyes, the nose, the mouth, and they will show them to the witness and say, does it look like this nose or was it more like this nose? And they do this until they get a usable picture of the person that the witness says they saw. Which is why if you go and look up Donald Nielsen or even Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, and look up for photo fits of these individuals, you'll see it looks like somebody copy and pasted the picture together. That's because that's really what it is that they do to build these things. They get a general structure of the head and they fill in the details after the fact. Which, as you think about it, is really a unique way to go about getting an idea of who it is that they should be looking for. On February 15th, 1974, Nielsen targeted a sub-post office in Harrogate, North Yorkshire. Upon gaining entry into the home, he tied up the 18-year-old son before moving back into the house, where he confronted the postmaster himself, Donald Skepper, as he lay in bed. Skepper attempted to foil the robbery by leaping at Nielsen, and Nielsen shot him. before fleeing the house. Donald Skepper ended up dying from his wounds. And it was at this point that the police began to tentatively link the two cases together. They put out a very large net to try and catch the man responsible for this murder, and ended up interviewing, by some accounts, over 30,000 people. Although they failed to locate the perpetrator. On September 6th, Nielsen broke into another sub-post office in Higher Baxendale, Lancashire, where he ran into the postmaster, Derek Austin. The two men began to tussle before making their way out into the hallway, and at the top of the flight of steps, Nielsen shot the postmaster before falling down the stairs and escaping. Austin died later at the hospital. With this crime, the police knew definitively that they had their man. It was the same individuals responsible for all three of these attacks. Somewhere during this time, the individual became known as the Black Panther, which, as I stated, was given to the manner of dress in which he wore, specifically the hood over his head. The police were able to further link the crimes together because of the bullets which were used in the two slayings. They found that they came from the same gun. In November of 1974, Nielsen struck again, this time at a sub-post office in Langley, West Midlands. He changed his MO with this attack by going to the back door and knocking. When the homeowner answered the door, Nielsen struck, rushing into the house and attempting to squirt the homeowner in the face with a bottle of ammonia. He ended up shooting himself in the face with the ammonia and was forced to rip off his mask. It was at this point that the homeowner, Sidney Grayland, his wife, walked into the room. And as she came into the room, Nielsen turned and began to bludgeon her in the head with the flashlight, after which he shot her husband before stealing $800 in postal orders from the safe. Mr. Grayland died from the shooting, and his wife was critically injured, although she did recover and was able to give the police a description of her assailant. After this, it seems as though Nielsen took a break from his criminal activities, at least as far as we know. And it was during this break that he began to come up with the plan to make a serious score by kidnapping someone and holding them for ransom. So after the body of Leslie Whittle was discovered in this shaft, it was quite a bit of time before the man responsible for it was captured. In fact, it was about a year until they found the man that they were looking for. And during this time, there was a huge investigation going on as they sought to identify who could be responsible. And the police came under fire when the coroner came out and stated that she had probably died within a few days of being kidnapped. Some reports state that they believe she died within 3 days of being kidnapped, others within the first 48 hours. It was noted, however, that she had not eaten anything in at least 3 days, as her intestines were empty at the time her body was found, and it takes a considerable amount of time time for food to make its way through the body. The police caught fire over this, as it's believed that had they searched this park in the days immediately following her disappearance, they may have found Leslie alive. Which, I'm sorry, but by all the things I have read, it seems like Nielsen was playing games with them, and that no matter what happened, he was not going to let her live. And even after the failed attempt to get the ransom money in the park, it was still a little bit of time before they found where she had been stored. In fact, they had to bring dogs in, and from what I understand, this was a fairly large park that they had to search through. So this idea that they would have been able to zero in on this park fairly quickly and discover her is just mind-boggling, as is the fact that they would have been able to save her after the botched attempt to get the ransom, as, according to Nielsen, as soon as he failed to make contact at 2:30 with Leslie's father in the park, he immediately went to where she was at and killed her. So there is no way that they would have been able to save her life. On the night of December 11th, 1975, two police officers, Tony White and Stuart McKenzie, were on patrol in a small marked police car. They were sitting on a side road keeping watch on the A60, which ran out of Mansfield into North Nottinghamshire. They spotted a man walking past them carrying something in his hands. And as the man walked past the car, they noticed that he turned away from them in an obvious effort to keep them from seeing his face. They demanded that the man come over and began questioning him as to what he was doing, and the man stated that he was on his way home from work. And inexplicably, the man produced a shotgun from inside this bag that he was carrying. Officer White had gotten out of the car to talk to the man, and Nielsen ordered him back into the car. The officer went to get into the front seat, and Nielsen snapped at him, "No time for that, get into the back." After White climbed into the back, Nielsen got in and jammed the shotgun into McKenzie's ribs before ordering him to drive off. And they drove to a town called Wainworth, which was about 6 miles away. Along the way, Nielsen ordered the two men not to look at him. This next bit is like something out of a bad comedy. As they're driving along, they tell him that they're going the wrong way to get to where he wants to go, that they'd have to turn around, and Nielsen agrees with the two men, warning them that if there's any tricks, he'll kill them both. And eventually, Nielsen asks them if there is any rope in the car, and well, one of the officers, White, pretends to look for it. They reach a crossroads, and McKenzie starts violently swerving the car left and right, demanding to know which way. And as he does this, Nielsen is thrown off his game and turns to look out the window, at which point White notices that the gun has moved away from his partner, and he leaps forward from the back seat and pushes the gun away so that it is facing towards the front of the car. While this is going on, McKenzie slams on the brakes and they come to a halt outside of a fish and chips shop in Rainworth. The gun goes off, grazing White's hand, and McKenzie falls out of the car, smacking his head on the concrete. McKenzie pulls himself from the ground and runs towards the fish and chip shop, screaming for help. Two men come running out of the fish and chip store, a Roy Morris and Keith Wood, and they help to overpower Nielsen. Apparently, Wood started punching him in the back of the neck while Morris grabbed his wrist and held it so that Nielsen couldn't bring the gun to bear on either of them. White then gets out of the car and slaps handcuffs on Nielsen. The two men who came over to help subdue the criminal, Morris and Wood, were beating Nielsen so badly that in the end the police had to stop their assault and actually protect the man who had taken them hostage from their saviors. After this, they handcuffed Nielsen to a railing while they awaited backup to arrive. Nielsen was brought to the police station where he was interrogated, and eventually he confessed to the kidnapping of Whittle. The police began to search Nielsen's home, and while there they found a number of items which had been stolen from various homes over the previous decade. They also discovered a fingerprint in the shaft where Whittle's body was found that matched Nielsen's. So, who was the man that they had in custody? Donald Nielsen was born, Donald Napy, was born on August 1st, 1936, of Bradford, West Riding of Yorkshire, England. By all accounts, Nielsen was bullied mercilessly when he was in school because of his last name being so similar to the word nappy, which is a British term for the word diaper. That word is spelled N-A-P-P-Y. Well, Donald's last name was spelled N-A-P-P-E-Y. His childhood was made more difficult when, in 1947, his 33-year-old mother died from breast cancer. And it seems that from this point on, he started running the streets. In 1948, he was arrested for shoplifting, although given his age, the police decided to give him a stern warning rather than send him to a hostel or other youth offender facility. At some point in the 1950s, he ended up joining the army, serving as an infantryman in the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry. And it was around this point that he met his wife, Irene Tate, who was 2 years older than he was. In April of 1955, 18-year-old Nielsen ended up marrying 20-year-old Tate. And it seems that he kind of had a knockabout existence from this point on, alternating between working menial jobs and committing burglaries. In 1960, the couple had a daughter by the name of Catherine, and in 1964, Nielsen decided to change their last name to Nielsen, as he did not want his daughter to suffer the abuse that he had growing up. Now, there's some discrepancies as to how he came upon the name Nielsen, although the most accepted is that he bought a taxi service from a man by the name of Nielsen and decided to continue using this name for the business, as well as taking it on as his own. Another theory comes from a man who lodged with the family in the early 60s who said that it came from an ice cream van that the couple bought ice cream for their daughter from. But in any event, Nielsen saw the name somewhere and decided that he liked it, and because of this, the family renamed themselves in 64. And it was around this time that his criminal activities really began to pick up, where Nielsen started robbing the homes that I described earlier in the episode, with the estimate of around 400 homes before he escalated to robbing the post offices. Various reasons have been given as to why he turned to full-time crime in the mid-1960s, but most of them center around the fact that he had a number of businesses that were failing, and in order to support both himself and his small family, he decided that the only way he could bring in a steady source of income was to take it from others. In interviews after his arrest, his wife Irene would go on to describe how her husband had really enjoyed the strict discipline of the military, and how she had been the one who convinced him not to pursue it full-time, but that he brought that discipline back home with him and would often force his wife and daughter to partake in a game of soldiers, wherein I assume he would make them march and stand at attention, among other things. After his arrest, Nielsen, as I stated, eventually admitted to having kidnapped Leslie Whitling, but he stated that her death was an accident, while going on to further tell the police that he had never meant to kill any of the postmasters and that he had simply been acting in self-defense. He was brought up on 4 charges of murder. While he was waiting for the trial to begin, Gerald Smith, who, if you'll remember, was the security guard that Nielsen had shot on the night that he kidnapped Leslie, he died as a result of his injuries from that shooting, although under UK law, Nielsen could not be charged with that murder. The reason for that is pretty odd. According to UK law at that time, a victim who was injured in such a manner that they later died from it, if it was a year and a day after the crime was committed that they died, their death was not considered a murder. Now, this law has since been changed, but the way the UK works, if you were to have committed a crime, say, in 1972, and 15 years later, somebody dies as a result of the crime that you committed, and then the police were to find out about that crime, you could not be charged with that murder, because the way the UK and a number of other places in the world work is that they charge you with the crime under the statutes that existed at the time of the crime taking place. Whereas in America, where if you shoot somebody and, you know, 5 years later they die, you're going to be charged with murder upon being found out. Just one of those interesting little things that I found while researching this case that is just mind-blowing to me. I knew about the UK charging people under the statutes that existed at the time a crime took place, but I had no idea that back then you could shoot somebody or grievously injure them, and if they died a year and a day later, then you couldn't be held responsible for that. Nielsen's trial began on June 4th, 1976 at the Oxford Crown Court, and was really the kind of thing, was like the crime of the century in England up until that point. The Yorkshire Ripper had not yet been apprehended. So Nielsen was really the center of attention as far as the populace and the news media was concerned. And the defense that was put on by Nielsen's solicitor was basically that he had not intended to kill Leslie. She'd been standing on a ledge. She was only 4 foot something tall, and the length of rope, which was tied, or wire rather, that had been put around her neck was over 9 feet long. They also contended that she slipped and fell from the ledge, and that the wire had become snagged, which resulted in her strangling to death. While further asserting that Nielsen had, in fact, intended to return the girl to her family, as he had been feeding her throughout the entire time of her incarceration. This, however, was rejected by the prosecution, as they showed that she had lost large amounts of weight while incarcerated. In fact, at the time of her death, it was estimated that she weighed around 98 pounds. And nothing was inside of her stomach, which, had he been feeding her in the days leading up to her incarceration, there would have been something there. On July 1st, Nielsen was convicted and given life sentences for each of the murders, along with another life term for causing grievous bodily harm to Mrs. Grayland, who, if you'll remember, was the wife of one of the postmasters. In a rare occurrence in English law, the judge who presided over the case informed Nielsen that in his case, life went life, and that he would not be getting out at any point. The reason I say that is oftentimes individuals in England are given what's known as a life sentence or a whole life tariff, and they don't end up serving that unless the government turns around and decides that in their case a whole life tariff is warranted, and usually that does not happen until long after they've been convicted. And Nielsen is one of those, because at some point in the late 1970s, early 1980s, they decided that his sentence should actually be 30 years, but it was changed by home secretaries who decided that no, the life tariff should be just that. Even still, he was going to be up for parole in July of 2006, which, as you will see, never came to pass. Before we get to that, however, we need to focus on his wife, Irene. On the evening that he was arrested, his wife became concerned and burned somewhere between 40 to 60 postal orders in the fire in their home. And when police came to search the home, they found the remains inside of their fire pit. The police further looked into Irene and found that she had cashed over 80 other postal orders that her husband had stolen. And according to her solicitor, Nielsen was a Svengoolie who had, quote-unquote, exercised a hypnotic influence over his wife and children. He was a quasi-military figure who barked orders at his wife and daughter, and woe betide anyone who disobeyed them. In the end, Irene ended up serving 12 months on remand for the cashing of these checks. And while she was in jail, she sold the rights to the family story for an undisclosed amount. After being released from jail about 6 years later, she went on the record with the Sunday People, claiming that she doubted if she would ever have been prosecuted or jailed for her crimes, except for the fact of who her husband was, and that the people in the area in which they lived had been demanding blood after the death of Leslie, and the full extent of her husband's crimes became known. And that's something that you actually see quite a bit of in England, is when somebody is jailed for, you know, a series of murders, more often than not, it seems that the British police then turn around and go after that person's spouse. I talked about how Nielsen would possibly be up for parole in 2006. The Home Office in Britain fought this adamantly, stating that he was on a whole life tariff and that given the nature and gravity of his crimes, whole life meant whole life. In 2008, he applied to have his minimum term reverted to the 30 years that it had been originally set at. On June 12th of 2008, the justice who was overseeing the case came out and said, "This is a case where the gravity of the applicant's offenses justifies a whole life order. The manner in which the young girl was killed demonstrates that it too involved a substantial degree of premeditation or planning. It also involved the abduction of the young girl. The location and manner of Leslie Whittle's death indicates that she must have been subjected by the applicant to a dreadful and horrific ordeal." On December 17, 2011, Nielsen, who had been at the Norwich prison, was taken to the Norwich and Norfolk University Hospital with difficulty breathing. He was pronounced dead the next day, December 18th of 2011, at the age of 75. That is it for the Deathcast this week. I hope you enjoyed my retelling of the story of Donald Nielsen, a.k.a. the Black Panther. If you enjoyed this episode, again, please like and share it on social media. Go to Apple Podcasts, leave a 5-star review. Please don't forget to go to Amazon and check out my novels, The Blood Gods Trilogy, The House of Silver Doors, and The Throwaway Girls of Olympia. And go to the website, Corpse Creek Publishing. Sign up for that mailing list if you have it and can spare it. Please leave a donation. Every amount helps with the production of this show. Until next time, I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. Stay morbid.
Welcome to the Deathcast.